Thanks. I'd like to thank the organizers, Jaroslav, and the organizers who aren't here, for giving me the opportunity to speak about our work with the organizer. So I'll be talking about some recent work that came out in April during this conference, and that's been work with Jake Borcelli and Jaroslav Trenka, who are both in the audience, about prescriptive unitarity. And I'll explain in this talk what we mean by prescriptive unitarity. And at the end of the talk, if Jaroslav doesn't have to run off to LA, I hopefully get some time to report on some work in progress with another collaborator. See here, we only have two J's. For the second work, we need a couple more J's. So we have JJ Stankiewicz, who is at Brown. So with these four J's, well, to keep track of them, we better label them with some indices. And we have four indices. A, B, C, D, and if we have four of them, we can do something with color. So that's the work in progress to talk about some non-planar amplitudes where we have to keep track of colors. So I'll start with some introduction and motivation about the unitarity approach in general. So just to set the stage of why we do this work and what we want to accomplish. So then to set the stage even more and to introduce all the concepts that I'll be using later on, I'll do a little warm-up exercise in the morning with two-loop planar n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory. I'll introduce the counting of basis integrands, which will be important in the three-loop story. And then I'll talk about some on-shell functions that play a key role in matching the amplitude, and I'll explain that there will be a one-to-one correspondence between these basis integrands and these on-shell functions. Then I'll in the third part I'll talk about our new result. This is this prescriptive approach for planar n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory at three loops for an arbitrary number of particles and for all n to the k MHV amplitudes. If time permits, I'll comment on some. So this is setting the stage is all in the context of super Young-Mills theory. In the fourth part, if I have some time, I'll mention some strategy how one can use the same approach for more general theories with more general power counting. And in the fifth part, I'd like to mention our new work that we did. That hasn't been published yet, about all number of particles, MHV amplitudes, and n equals 4 super Young-Mills theory in the non-planar setting. So this is like the first honest all integrand in the non-planar setting. Okay. All right. So let me make a little disclaimer. As I said, I'll work at the level of the integrand, and so that is amplitudes before integration, and most of the story will be in strictly four dimensions. We believe that it will be possible to lift the story up for general dimensions, but it requires some more work, and the counting is gonna be a little different from what I'll be reporting here. Okay, so. Before I start, let me give you the main slogan of what comes out of this. And the main slogan is this prescriptive unitarity that I'll introduce. Will be a generalized unitarity without linear algebra. I think many of us are used to solving bigger systems of linear equations, and we're completely fine with that. But here we'd like to push for an approach where we do not have to, our linear systems of equations will not grow, and that's what I mean by without linear algebra. So that's going to be the take-home message at the end of the day. So why are we doing this? So in the past, we've seen that it was always a good idea, or a key ingredient to make progress is to generate theoretical data and study this theoretical data and then recognize patterns. And that taught us a lot about quantum field theory in general, a lot of progress has been made in this way, in particular in planar n equals 4 super Yang-Wells theory, or in supersymmetric gauge theory and maximal supergravity. So just to name a few, like BCFW recursion relation was kind of discovered at loop level. BCJ duality was also discovered by studying theoretical data at loop level, and so on and so forth. So staring at this theoretical data taught us in the past a lot about the theory. So what we want to do is, so since this theoretical data seems so valuable, we want to get efficient methods to generate this theoretical data. So this is the key. One of the key motivations that we have. We want to have a nice tool, an efficient tool to generate this theoretical data. Of course, there's like a completely different type of motivation, and that is like from a more practical point of view, where one would like to use new tools to help one for like actual practical calculations for collider physics, for example. So I'm not going to mention anything about collider physics here, but just to keep in the back of your mind. So what are the objects we're usually studying? And these are scattering amplitudes, of course. The entire workshop is on these guys. So in general, a loop amplitude will be a function of the external, still be some function of the external data, momenta, polarizations, and some other quantum numbers that would label the external states. So scattering amplitudes are, loop amplitudes are multivalued functions, and they have complicated branch cut structures. They're in planar n equals 4 for certain theories. There's a beautiful story how one would, how one can bootstrap these functions. Principles, and that is like beautiful work by Lenz and like his collaborators. Okay, so these are complicated functions, as I mentioned, with branch cut singularities, and it's an interesting question: what kind of functions can come out of a quantum field theory in general? But this is not going to be the part of this talk. So, these multivalued functions are at the moment they're a little too complicated for me, so I don't want to touch them right now. So what we do instead is we're going to study these functions. Well, that comes in the fall, I think. There comes the study of the integrated amplitudes. What I want to do instead is I want to work at the level of the integrand. And the integrand is basically the scattering amplitude before doing the Feynman integration. So what we do is we strip off the integration Li. What does it buy us? The integrand is a much simpler function. It's a meromorphic function that depends on the external data, polarizations, momenta, quantum numbers, and the internal degrees of freedom, these loop degrees of freedom. But it is a meromorphic function, not a multivalued function with branch cuts. So what is nice about this class of functions is, so you look at the old S matrix book, and the first thing you read when you open the book is in the preface is the slogan that one of the most remarkable discoveries in particle physics is that of the existence of the complex plane. So I think we heard this slogan before in this conference, but what do I mean by that for our prescriptive unitarity approach is the following. Since the integrand is a meromorphic function, we can reconstruct it from all of its residues. So knowing the residues of this function, basically is the same as knowing the function. Okay. So that's fine. So how can we hook that up with physics? So what do we know about scattering? What do we know about scattering amplitudes? Let's first start from tree level. So I want to connect the meromorphic function and its residues. So what do we know about amplitudes? If we know that amplitudes factorize. So if we take a scattering amplitude at tree level, we know that this guy factorizes into a product of simpler objects, lower point amplitudes, and locality and unitarity tells us that the only poles we can have in the scattering amplitude are the 1 over p squared poles, and unitarity will tell us, so locality tells us that also that it's going to be a product. These can be arbitrarily separated in space-time. So locality will tell us it's a product, and unitarity will tell us it's going to be a consistent factorization into the product of tree amplitudes, and quantum mechanics tells us we're supposed to sum over all exchanged states. Okay, so this is the tree level. The second thing we know, now we can go even one step further. Let's go to loop level, and I think everyone has seen a picture like this, that the imaginary part of a loop amplitude is going to be related to the cut, to the cut cost, to the well-known cut cost, key cut, where the discontinuity is given by the product of tree amplitudes integrated over the on-shell phase space. Okay, so that was known in the 50s or 60s, and then Lance, Svi, David Kossauer, and Dave Dunbar came along and put this approach more or less on steroids, and came up with this generalized unitarity method. So who tells you that you can only take one unitarity cut? I can iterate this procedure and take multi-particle cuts. So if I complexify my variables, this is a completely valid thing to do. And as we're already motivated, we like the complex planes anyway. So why don't we do this? So we can start with a regular two-particle cut, and then we can go. So there, in four dimensions, for a one-loop thing, there will be 4 degrees of freedom in a D4L integration. Localizing on a two-particle cut gives us two constraints, so we have 2 degrees of freedom left, and we can factorize further with these degrees of freedom. So taking one further factorization gives us some triangle thing. This still depends on 1 degree of freedom, which we can still use to go on yet another factorization channel. And now in 4 dimensions, now we've set 4 things on shell, so we've localized 4 degrees of freedom, and we would call this a leading singularity. I think this term has been coined by Freddy Cacciazzo and others.
He copied it from the analytic S matrix book.
Okay, great. Well, okay, well, the old guys knew everything, almost everything. Okay, so in these leading singularities, they'll play a key role in the story that I'm going to tell. Okay, so before coming to prescriptive unitarity, let me explain a little bit closer what generalized unitarity does for you. So, generalized unitarity basically writes the amplitude in a compact form by introducing objects that have the same singularity structure as the amplitude itself. So let's look at a simple example at one loop. In 4 dimensions, And like, let me focus on what's called the parity even part for now. At one loop, there's the famous story. We know the one loop basis of integrals, which is basically there's some coefficient for the box times the box integral. This triangle coefficient, the triangle, the bubble coefficient, the bubble, and then in general one could also have tadpoles and rational pieces, but let me not talk about them here. Tadpoles for massless internal states integrate to zero in dim reg, and rational pieces one could in principle get by going to higher dimensions, but that's just a side comment. Okay, so what would a generalized unitarity do in order to reconstruct the amplitude? So the name of the game in the generalized unitarity method is to set up some system of equations to determine these coefficients in front of the integrals. Okay, and how does one do that? One does that by looking at factorizations of the amplitude. So one matches the factorizations of the amplitude with the possible factorizations of the ansatz that one writes down here, and then sets up systems of equations to solve for these coefficients. So the first equation that one could be using is that of the quadruple cut. And in the ansatz, only this integral has the quadruple cut, so one can easily see that one gets some constraint. One can get information about this box coefficient. Okay, so then one can solve for this box coefficient that way. So now, in order to motivate generalized unitarity, let me go one step further.
Sorry, I have a really stupid question. Why don't you consider cuts with more than four legs?
In four dimensions, in four dimensions, your loop momentum has 4 degrees of freedom, d4l. So you cannot put more you only have 4 degrees of freedom that you need to fix. So if you have higher, well, said differently, in four dimensions, everything with higher numbers of propagators is what's called reducible. You can do an integral reduction, and you can get rid of all these higher.
That's not true.
Well, for the integrant, not like for the yes. So for the integrant, you can go down to pentagons in four dimensions. You can go down to what are called parity odd pentagons, but these parity odd pentagons, once integrated over the parity even Minkowski contour, they integrate to zero. So for this purpose, we can just drop them for now.
So you say that, am I understanding correctly? There could be a high order singularity in the integrant, but you say they integrate to zero. That's the same.
Or you can partial fraction them out.
Yeah,
you part sums over things that only have four at a time.
Basically. Yeah. So this partial fractioning. That's the integral reduction. So you can get rid of these, and I'll explain a little bit how that works in the context of these planar theories. Okay. All right. Okay. So let's go to. So in order to motivate our prescriptive approach to unitarity, we should be looking at something. We also need to fix these triangle bubble coefficients in principle. So let's just look at the triangle. So at the triangle coefficient, we could go. The amplitude has a factorization like this. So this would be a one-parametric function in general. But now, on this cut, we already see there's overlap between all the boxes and the triangles. So both of these integrals have this cut. So what that means is that in order to extract information about this triangle coefficient, one would have to solve a linear algebra system because all these boxes in general would contribute. So that's what the generalized unitarity would do. You would subtract out, like you'd basically solve this combined system you already know information about the box coefficient, and then you'd still have to solve. You'd still have to solve some linear system of equations in order to get the information about these triangle coefficients. Okay, so at one loop, this is all doable. It's not a big problem. But if you go higher and higher in loop orders, this pollution, these higher integrals polluting these lower cuts, is going to be computationally like very very hard. It's going to be computationally tough. So the motivation for prescriptive unitarity is that while we're in California here, so we don't like pollution anymore. So we don't want these higher integrals to pollute on these lower dimensional cuts. And I'll explain how we avoid this pollution. Okay. So
maybe it's worth saying that Darren Ford at one loop, showed how to.
Yes. So at one loop, yes.
There's different ways to do it.
So at one loop, there's a story, as Lance mentioned, of Darren Ford. There is a certain residue at infinity how you can extract uniquely this triangle integral. But since I just wanted to use this as a motivation, not as like, not saying that we'll beat like the one loop story, but like going for higher loops, I think Darren Ford, well, if he hadn't left physics, he would be hard pressed to use his method to get these coefficients at higher loops or make them more systematic. Okay. Instead of having these overlaps, what we are going to do is we'd construct basis elements up here at the top, so in such a way that they vanish on certain points that are used to define these lower dimensional cuts. So this is the entire power of this prescriptive unitarity approach. We do a one-to-one mapping between integral basis elements and their associated cuts. So they'll get mapped one to one, and in order to fix them uniquely, they'll be specified up to contact terms. And in order to nail that contact term, degrees of freedom, in such a way, by demanding that they vanish on all other cuts that are used to fix basis integrand basis elements. Okay. So let's do this. Let's do our little warm up exercise at two loops. I see I have to speed up a little bit. So, a two-loop warm-up in planar n equals 4 superangles, and what we're doing is we're looking at all n to the k MHV amplitudes. By these two gentlemen, there is a result for this two-loop amplitude in the literature, and that's in 1508-86 by Yaroslav and Jake. So the representation for the amplitude that we're constructing here is going to be slightly different from theirs, in the sense that they were very careful in making the IR structure of the integrand, exposing the IR structure of the integrand. So here we're going for a slightly different approach. We're kind of going for uniformity. We don't want to treat special cases. We want to treat everyone equal. And it turns out from some point of view, this is like a good thing to do because we get an even more compact representation of the integrand. So at this two-loop warm-up, I'll basically introduce all the key players that are going to be featured at three loops. So most of the things that we encountered at two loops, they'll also be there just in a more prominent way at three loops. Okay. So motivated by this one loop story, so how are we doing? How are we going about this? So the first thing to do is you're looking at the set of unitarity cuts that you possibly have to match. So that tells us that tells you something of what types of integrals you would have to that you'd need to introduce, because you of course have to have objects that have these types of unitarity cuts. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to match the full amplitude. So what do we get at what do we get at two loops? So at two loops, we get like the pictures we can get looks like something like this. So I'm now. So the pictures I'm drawing is like these factorization pictures of amplitudes where all lines you see here are unshell amplitudes, and these blobs in the corner are tree-level amplitudes. Okay. And on top of that, I'll label my pictures with little letters I and J. And these I and J's, in this case, run from 1 to 2, and they label these quadruple cuts or solutions to. Well, you solve four quadratic equations, said differently, like one quadratic and three linears once you're on support of one of the cuts. And these quadruple cut equations have two solutions. And this I and J labels the solution one and solution two to these quadruple cut equations. Okay, so we have a picture like this. And then there's some other picture. It looks like this. So that tells us something like what potential integrals we might have to introduce. So note that there's I and J, and each I and J runs over 1 to 2. So there's four pictures in total here, and there will be four pictures for this type of topology. So the first thing you would try in order to match these amplitudes, well, why don't we introduce an integral? That looks like this. So we take a kissing box. We take a kissing box integral. So now there's something about n equals 4 supernormal sphere that many people here will be familiar with, and that's the no triangle. There is no triangles in n equals 4. Alternatively, these box numerators they have scalar numerators. You're not supposed to put a tensor numerator in. And in the planar case, this is determined by a dual conformal. By dual conformal invariants. We'll come back to that in the nonplanar story. It turns out you can, by violating the manifest power counting is sometimes a good idea, but let me come to this later. Okay, so key point is this is a double box, so there's no numerator, there's only a single numerator degree of freedom that you have, and that's you can fix the overall normalization of this integral. So because you don't have any tensor insertions here, so you cannot do anything. So but now it comes the key observation that 4 is not equal to 1. So we would have one integral, one basis element, but we have to match four different unshell functions, four different residues of the amplitude. So we cannot do it with that integral. So that's a bad idea. So what we have to do instead is we have to allow ourselves the freedom to introduce tensor numerators. With these tensor numerators, we can do something nice.
So 4 is 2 times 2, meaning the two solutions to the quadruple cut on the left and 2 on the right?
Yeah, so I and J, so I runs over 1 to 2, J runs over 1 to 2, 2 times 2 is 4. Okay. Okay. So what we can do instead, and well, that's already been known. That's been known for a while. It's a good idea here. It's a good idea to introduce another propagator in the middle of these two legs, and now you have two pentagons. And now for these pentagons in n equals 4, the power counting dictates that you can insert a tensor numerator on each side. Okay. So now let's count. Now comes the key part of this entire story. It's degrees of freedom counting. So what are the degrees of freedom?
So like at one loop, there's also you could put in a box with one loop momentum in the numerator. That's what OPP did, or you can kind of weight the solutions to the different quadruple cuts differently and extract two pieces of information.
Yeah.
So is your whole principle to sort of stay consistent with dual conformal invariants, or an analog of that, or not?
So for planar n equals 4, for the three loop story that I'm going to tell you, yes, this is what we did. We stuck to a manifest n equals 4 power counting. If I have the time, I see I'm running massively late probably. It's in this non-planar story, in the non-planar two loop MHV amplitude non-planar, it turned out to be better to violate the n equals 4 power counting and do exactly kind of what you suggested, just put the numerator in the box and then kill all the spurious poles at infinity that you've introduced with triangle and lower integrals.
Yeah.
But here, for the planar case, we don't want to, it wasn't necessary, and...
it is necessary one loop, which is a little...
Surprising. Yeah, so I didn't want to mention one loop because there's a little subtlety. I don't really want to go into the subtlety at one loop, but I'm happy to discuss this afterwards. Okay, let me come back to the degrees of freedom power. So we're allowed to introduce one power of inverse propagators on each side. So what are the powers? So what's the basis of inverse propagators if we can insert one power? So we can have just a scalar numerator, and then L dot K1, L dot. Then in four dimensions, we can pick a basis of four vectors, K3.K4, and then there's the quadratic guy, L squared. And this spans the space of inverse propagators. So we see that this guy is six dimensional. So, yes?
Yeah, but if you stick to the 4D, this time dimension, then this L square is not something independent. It can be expressed as a quadratic function of the first five variables. It's OPP, standard OPP procedure. If you just use 4D, no extra space time, then L square is just a quadratic function of that.
No,
it's definitely.
No, it will be independent. You can set.
You can express L square in terms of linear functors, quadratic functors.
Yes, a quadratic function, so it's dependent. It's not.
But it's not
a
sum of linear factors. It's quadratic.
Yeah, it's said differently. There's a different argument why this thing is six. You can like in dual space, you can count this in dual space. So you are allowed to write one term in the numerator where this is what this y. It's a bi-twister, and a bi-twister is an anti-symmetric 4x4 of SU4, so this also has 6 degrees of freedom.
Well, let's try Yang's argument a different way. K1 to K4, if they're independent and not degenerate, I could make any vector in four-dimensional space-time out of them, because there's four of them, right? So then I can get every component of L by dotting it into an appropriate linear combination of those k's. This k1 to k4 span four-dimensional space-time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then I can get any component, L0, L1, L2, L3, by dotting into appropriate k, and then I can form L squared out of that. I think that's what Yang's saying.
Yeah, but that would violate your power conflict. You would get L dot k1 squared.
Yeah.
All right. So you have a power counting criterion, which is a little different from the ordinary power counting criterion.
We would.
That two L's looks like it could be satisfied.
L dot K one, L dot L dot K two is. This would we would count this as array as two powers, not as one power. So any linear L dot K. is at the same footing as L, is secretly is in the same footing as L squared.
The point is that we only want to consider numerators that are inverse propagators.
Yeah.
And that spans all Lorentz invariant monomials, but it is a different organization of Lorentz invariant monomials.
Yeah.
Or in the dual space.
Yeah. So
you have five propagators around. You're allowed to put one dual guy from the side.
Or
to the other one.
So we noted the basis is six dimensional, and now we come to this how we split the basis, and exactly what Lenz has been suggesting is there's a nice organization of this basis for these pentagons. So there are A, B, C, D. Let's call these propagators A, B, C, D. So we can, for our six-dimensional basis, we can use these four inverse propagators. So that spans a four-dimensional space. And then on top of that, so what are we doing for this pentagon? So let me change notation a little bit. We take the inverse propagator LA, LB, LC, LD. So this gives us four, and then there's two more natural things we can choose, and these are the two solutions to the quad-cot equation, which we call LQ1. So these are now complex points, and LQ2. So this is how we organize our basis, and then as Lenz mentioned, these are the four contact terms. And these guys do not collapse any propagators, and these we call them like top level degrees of freedom. So what are the degrees of freedom? So now we can decompose this object. So each pentagon has 6 degrees of freedom. So this guy has 6 times 6 is 36. But we split these 6 in two top-level degrees of freedom plus 4 contact terms times 2 plus 4 for each side. But now we see already something nice emerging. So we have two top-level degrees of freedom for the left pentagon, 2 top-level degrees of freedom for the right pentagon. So and 2 times 2 makes 4. Which we can use to match these four cuts one to one. So we have 4 degrees of freedom. We have 4 cuts we want to match. One of these degrees of freedom matches one cut and vanishes on all others. So that's how we match these 4 degrees of freedom.
So does this include the L1.L2 type degree of freedom, or is that only over on the next integral?
For the planar case, we like to keep this middle leg out. And said differently, so in this basis that we have here, the middle inverse propagator can be expanded in terms of basis elements on the left and the right. So and it's much more natural to not associate this middle propagator to one particular side. That would break the symmetry. You could assign it to one side or the other, but it would break the symmetry. So we find it much more natural to write the basis where we only touch these unshared propagators. And then, like, we're collapsing the middle guy is spanned by our basis. So we've talked about these double pentagons now. There is a more general counting, how you can count how many degrees of freedom there are associated with inserting more powers of these inverse propagators. And for our purposes, the only thing we need is if we insert one power, we get 6 degrees of freedom. If we insert 2 powers, we get 20 degrees of freedom. You can motivate this counting by studying symmetric traceless representations of SO6. That gives you exactly this counting.
So are you now capturing all the topologies on the right at the same time?
No, let me come to the right now.
Yeah, I mean it's contact terms included.
Yeah,
stuff.
Yeah. So one step at a time. Okay. So now look. Now let's look at this guy. So the natural integral that one would associate to this integral or to these cuts would be something like this. But now we run it like, well, now you might naively think that there's a problem. So there's four pictures to match here, but this integral only has 2 degrees of freedom. So you cannot write two top level degrees of freedom. So whenever I draw an integral like this, I'm now counting only the top level degrees of freedom modulo all these contact terms that have to be fixed later on. So this guy only has 2 degrees of freedom because there's nothing I can do on the box side. So the box, it's the same what we discussed before. So now you'd say, okay, 4 is not equal to 2. So is there a problem? The answer is no, there is not a problem, because these cut pictures are not independent. They satisfy relations. They satisfy what are called GRTs, or some residue theorems. And I can show how one of these residue theorems will look like. And that will motivate that we do not have to match all the pictures. We do not have to match all cuts one by one. If we match a sufficient subset of cuts by the GRTs, we are guaranteed to get the other ones. We're guaranteed to get the other ones correct.
But I mean, GRT. This is a bit circuitous because the fact of the matter is that
Yes.
If you have a complete basis and you've defined the coefficient of every term in the complete basis.
Yeah, you're guaranteed. Yes,
if everything else works.
Yes, yeah. Yes, of course. That's also an argument. Let me come back to that. Let me make that argument later. Let me just say how we naively get the other two cuts correct first. Okay, so we start from this triple cut on the left-hand side. So there's 1 degree of freedom, which we can take a Cauchy residue theorem on. So what do we get? So this thing, factorizes into kissing boxes. J here. J plus. The sum over both solutions I and J. And Cauchy's theorem tells us that this sum equals 0. So you see that these pictures are not all independent, but they satisfy the residue theorem. So what this residue theorem allows us is to eliminate one of these pictures and trade them for the remaining pictures. And this is exactly what happens. So what we can do then is, so we match all of these pictures. We've matched all these pictures with this double pentagon integral. These double pentagon integrals have support on this cut. And then what we're doing, we have to match one guy. We have to match one of these pictures. And for the sake of argument, we choose this picture to be 1. So we match one of these cuts and all of these cuts. And then the residue theorem tells us that we get the second cut on this box correct automatically. So now let's come back to Jake's argument. We were guaranteed to get this thing correct. We started with a complete basis of integrands, and we fix all top-level degrees of freedom. We pick this independent set of cuts. We pick these 4 cuts, and we pick these 2 cuts to fix these 4 top-level degrees of freedom here and these two top-level degrees of freedom here. So now we've completely fixed all the coefficients of our basis elements. So there's nothing else we can add to it. So by the completeness of the basis, we are guaranteed to match this to get this fourth cut correct automatically. So now let me comment on the prescriptive nature of unitarity. So as I mentioned, these integrals here would have in principle support on these cuts. So now you might say, okay, so now you're exactly the same. Now you're exactly in the same situation as generalized unitarity was. But now comes the crucial part. So these basis elements here for this integral are constructed to give unit on their associated cut. And then the prescriptive nature instructs us that on top of that, all their contact degrees of freedom are specified by vanishing on all cuts that are used to determine other basis elements that are used to fix other elements in our integrand basis. So in particular, all of these guys we demand them to vanish on this cut, because this cut is associated to this integral and this integral alone. So you can do that by it's just a subtracting out. If that guy had support here on this solution, you just subtract out whatever contribution there was. So then at the end, after this procedure, you just get zero on this cut. And that guarantees that, this procedure guarantees that on the other cut solution, you get these guys have support in order for the residue theorem to work, and you match this cut. Okay. Are there any questions about this procedure? Yeah.
Is this procedure faster than the standard OPP procedure doing the linear algebra?
Well, for one thing, we write a closed formula.
Yeah.
Okay. There is no linear algebra. There's you have to do steps.
Yeah.
Practice,
So we diagonalize the system a priori. We don't. Yeah. So that in that sense, we have a diagonal system, so there's no...
We also sort of solved the OPP linear algebra by using these Fourier projectors.
Yeah, not a two loops.
No.
Yeah.
But you said OPP.
Yeah.
Are you talking about two loop OPP or one loop OPP?
Because my feeling is, of course, it's a very beautiful construction, but I guess that this is... if you really use integrand reduction, especially with the D-dimensional integrand reduction, and OPP plus for a group of basis is kind of generalized OPP method. But basically, all these kind of linear algebra steps are gone. Because in D-dimension, this kind of thing is not there. Because in D-dimension, you don't need to fit in this kind of integrand basis coefficients with some terms on the card. Because it's just a one-to-one correspondence. Only for fault, you have this kind of thing. You really need to extract the coefficients. That's my feeling.
Well, I mean, in some sense, it's
of course, it solved another problem, because when I said it, when I still this kind of high topology with a blue to lower. But this step, if you use D-dimension, it's just a subtraction, it's just a clean up of this regression function. It's not linear algebra. Although it's a slow process, but it's not a linear algebra problem.
You might say that this is the same thing with 4D. I mean, because basically, in both cases, you're starting off, the system starts off life as basically upper triangular. And so the linear algebra amounts are just subtracting off pieces.
Yeah.
And it's the same in the D-dimensional case that you're talking about, and also, but in here we're doing that, we get the same system in 4D.
Okay.
But it's very close in spirit. I mean, going to the Grover basis is like going to these cut bases.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're, a priori, we're already motivated by these cut pictures that we're seeing. And this is inspired by these cuts we want to match. That's how we construct a priori these basis elements, or they're defined with respect to these cuts. So, let me leave it like this. Okay. Okay. So there's one. Okay. So we've matched. So note that all these things were matched on leading. All these pictures, they have 4L cuts. They have eight on-shell propagators. So these are matched by leading singularities. There are some other. If you go further down, there's something that is also heavily featured at three loops, and that's the following. So at two loops, you have integrals in your basis that look like this. So this is by now a kind of a famous integral. So these only has seven propagators. And if you go to the heptacut of this integral, this thing behaves like, on this remaining degree of freedom, it behaves like dc over square root of some quartic. of some quartic in C. So for this guy, there's no natural, there's no other, this quartic doesn't have any further singularities. So there's no additional residue that you can take. So, but what you can do instead, also there was some beautiful, there was some work by you, like you evaluated this elliptic curve on some periods, and then constructed, use that as your defining property of the integral. But what we can do instead is, okay, we look at this function at this cut, and it only has one degree of freedom. The only thing it can have is the overall normalization. So why don't we fix the normalization on just some arbitrary point? And that's the way this is done for us. What we're doing is, well, we can actually go one step back. So here, if we do take the heptacut, it has all these square roots inside. If we take one step back on the hexacut, it still stays rational. The hexacut, it's a function, the function of two variables, x star and y star. And what we can do is to fix this integral, we just evaluate this Unschel function on some random point, x star, y star, and do the same thing. We go to the same cut of this integral and evaluate this cut also on the same random point, x star, y star, and that fixes this degree of freedom. And then we are done. There, because we started with n equals 4 power counting, there's no triangles inside. We fixed from the top to the bottom every basis element in the integrand. And then, so that means we're done. We've matched the amplitude. We've matched the integrand completely. And then we get a very compact formula that, these double pentagons were dressed with the kissing box cuts. The pentabox was matched with the pentabox cut, and then these double boxes are matched with their respective cuts. And then the amplitude is going to be a sum of all these objects. Okay, so with this method, now generalizes.
So you get a compact formula. Do you evaluate those coefficients?
Pardon?
Yeah. In terms of the external momenta only?
No. Well, they also depend on these reference points.
Right.
They depend on, yeah.
And, of course, there shouldn't be any... those reference points were functions of the kinetic.
So this is...
Yeah, and you can choose them in a way so it's dual conformal.
Yeah, yeah. So, of course, So as I said, in the nature of prescriptive unitarity, it means that all higher integrals that would have support on these cuts, they have to vanish. And they have to vanish at exactly this point, x star and y star, that you've used to specify this integral. Because this cut on this point is already matched by this integral. So you shouldn't have any higher integral to screw up the cut that you've already fixed. So the way we mod out the contact degrees of freedom of these higher integrals is by exactly demanding that they match on all lower cuts that are used to specify different basis elements. So that's the prescriptive nature of unitarity. Okay, so in the remaining 5 minutes or so, let me come to the actually new result, to the three-loop result. So for three loops, we used kind of exactly the same arguments as I explained for two loops. So for three loops, the pictures, the type of pictures that you have to match are these three guys at the top. So you have some kissing box type generalization, these other class of kissing boxes, and yeah, so these three classes of kissing boxes. So each of them has 8 degrees of freedom. It's 2 to the 3, and you have to find integrals that match these degrees of freedom. Of course, as we saw in the two-loop case, you will not use the box integrals themselves because they only have one degree of freedom. So what you're naturally led to is you're led to integrals of this class. So there's, so you have some hexagon integrals that turns out at the top. These also have 2 degrees of freedom. So you'll introduce integrals like this. Integrals like this, where you have a pentagon, hexagon, pentagon, and then some different class of this, some pentagon, hexagon, pentagon with a little different like assignment. And it turns out each of them has 2 times 2 times 2 top level degrees of freedom. So you can match each of these top integrals. You can associate them to one of these cuts. And then it's the name of the game is to go down and fix all these contact degrees of freedom, on respective Angel functions. And the same as here, we cannot use only leading singularities. There are not enough leading singularities to fix all basis elements. So we have to go evaluate on-shell functions on random points. And then the same in the prescriptive approach, we have to demand that all the higher integrals, all the higher basis elements that could have support on the points that we've chosen to match the lower ones, that they vanish there because we do not want to screw up the cuts that get matched by the lower integrals. So this story basically works beautifully. And accounting, everything works out up to one. There's one kind of special case where attention is required, and we describe this. I can show which case it is. It's some triple pentagon integral. It turns out, so for pentagons where you only have 3 external propagators, you have 3 top level degrees of freedom. So you have 3 to the 3 is, so this integral has 27 degrees of freedom at the top in our basis, but you only have 15 independent leading singularities that you can match. So you need 12 more points. You need 12 more points to fix all degrees of freedom of this integral. And then the way to do it, so the leading singularity pictures look exactly like this topology, and then you can choose some 11 cuts, evaluate them in some specific point C star. So you choose for, so there's a S3 symmetry in this guy. So you choose 3 solutions. So in principle, there's 4 solutions. There's I, J. We choose 3 of them. Times 3 for the S3, so that gives you 9 degrees of freedom. So you're still short 3. So what you can do, so this looks so C1 star, C2 star. So naively, you could have chosen all 4 of them. That would have fixed all 27 degrees of freedom here. But it turns out there's overlap on this type of cut. There's overlap from, for example, this topology. And it turns out if you choose all four solutions on this side, you cannot have this integral vanish on all 4 degrees of freedom. So there's some mismatch here. So that's why we had to go down one step. So there's 3 times 1 degree of, this guy has 1 degree of freedom. So we had to go down one step. So that required some magic that it's possible for the prescriptive unitarity approach to succeed, to have this guy happens to vanish on these 3 cuts that we've chosen here and this cut on this fourth cut. And there's like some integral residue theorems that probably guarantee that these 4 points that the top integral vanishes on these 4 points, but that's some more that required some magic. Okay, so let me skip the higher power counting. There is a last chapter, a last section in our paper deals with more general power counting, where we allow higher powers of numerator insertions. into the basis on it, where now even triangles, for example, can have a tensor numerator, and that allows you to go down to bubble power countings. But this is explained in our paper, and let me just, in the last minute, let me just...
While you're raising it, I mean, it's worth commenting that you can always write a theory with some power counting in terms of an integral basis with the worst power counting.
Yeah.
Without any loss of generality.
So and then just cancel. Yeah, it's always... Yeah.
So if you have a basis of bubbles, triangles, and boxes, you can get n equals 4.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the only reason why you wouldn't do it is because the bubbles all kind of cancel out.
It's a
tricky thing to do for n equals 4. But you can do it. You get the right answer.
Yeah, it's always... Yeah, the n equals 4 power counting is a subspace. Yeah, of course, it will be a subspace in this more general power counting. And... So this is actually, yeah, so I guess with this comment, it's that's actually what we are going to do for the non-planar two-loop MHV amplitudes. Let me just draw some pictures. Let me just draw one picture because of lack of time. So let's look at this integral. So now MHV, so the chiral nature matters. So what I called I and J, if you have massless corners around, it's kind of, these are encoded in having white vertices or blue vertices. So these would be the two different solutions to the two chiral solutions of the quadruple cut equations. So now comes the point. So here you have a hexagon and here you have a box. So if you stick to n equals 4 power counting, you know that the box is parity even. So it would have support on both the white coloring as well as the blue or the black coloring. Of course, if you want to match the MHV integrand, you want your basis elements to only have support on the MHV solution and not have support on the MHV bar solution. Okay, so you need to do something again to allow yourself to write a tensor numerator that allows you to the tensor numerator that vanishes on this solution and only has support on this solution. Okay, so we were playing around with, like, how do we do it? How did we do it in the planar case? Well, that we introduced another physical propagator in between these two pentagons, and that was enough to give us enough degrees of freedom to allow a tensor numerator on the left side and the right side. So we were playing around with a similar argument in this non-planar case, but it turns out the color organization, and it turned out to be the color organization was more complicated. It was a little confusing, like how the picture, because now all these on-shell picture they're dressed with color. These are color dressed trees that are sitting inside this picture. So you have to both match color and kinematics at the same time. So introducing introducing integrals with larger number of propagators, with larger than 8 propagators, was a little confusing. So we did exactly what Jake said, or as Jake mentioned before. So why don't we just push the power counting of n equals 4 and kill all the bad power counting further down? So what we are now doing is we're allowing a tensor numerator insertion in the box at the cost of having to go down to triangles. And allowing ourselves to insert a tensor numerator here, we can uniquely select out this white solution versus the black solution. And then, of course, in the decomposition, we go further down and match the amplitude, fix all these lower integrals on other cuts. So in some sense,
in the two-loop four-point case, where you all massless, where you can do this integral, there's a sense in which the integral wants a loop momentum inside that box to make it uniform transcendental.
No. No, this is the pentagon.
The pentagon.
So this is this is L, and this is A and B.
I thought I could reroute it so it was inside the box.
No. The UT numerators for this is L plus A squared,
right.
And L plus B squared. Yeah. So these are the we constructed these D log integrals like a while ago. So let me just comment one quick comment. So In some sense, introducing this higher power counting is equivalent to saying I introduce a spurious pool. I introduce a spurious pool at infinity, and that allows me to push. That allows me to push the power counting. So there's like it's kind of equivalent to what Yaroslav and Jake what they did with this chiral box expansion, where they wrote some completely unphysical LX pole into the box expansion, and then showed that the spurious pole canceled. So this the spurious pole we are choosing now is the pole at infinity, is the pole at infinity, and that allows us to boost. That's basically the boosted power counting. And we for NX4 we have to kill. We have to kill the pole at infinity later on. All right. So let me stop here because I'm out of time and Yaroslav has to go. Are there any questions? There were a couple of questions in between, I guess. So.
Let's thank Enrico.